Bloodshot Bill, and you're listening to 90.7 FM, WGXC, o'clock.
On June 17th, three bands come to Tubby's in Kingston. First, E, the trio of Jason Sidney Sanford, Thalia Zedek, and Gavin McCarthy play rock music. A Live Skull, the renowned 1980s post-punk experimental rock band, is back together and are playing on this show with Upper Wilds, who record for Thrill Jockey and feature multi-instrumentalist songwriter Dan Friel, who's best known for his work in the band Parts and Labor. E, Live Skull, and Upper Wilds play at Tubby's in Kingston June 17th, and you can find out more about this show and many others on the WGXC community calendar online at wgxc.org.
WGXC underwriting support is provided in part by SunCommon, supporting vibrant communities across New York for 15 years, offering custom solar installations for homes, farms, and businesses. Information at suncommon.com.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Henning's Local Test Kitchen in Round Top, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a sustaining supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate. Thank you for your support.
Welcome to Ginger Radio Hour. I'm Justin, live in the Acre studio of WGXC 90.7 FM. Today, a focus on collections and archives, rare and disappearing things, endangered species, and greatest hits.
She spit it, snuff and boogie, try I'm on drain. Spit on! They say I'm different cause I eat chitlins. I can't help it, I was born and raised on them. That's right, every morning have to slop the hogs and they be getting off humping the Jolly Hooker. Moonshine, the Baby King and Jimmy Lee rock on that. And that's why they say I'm different. And that's why they say I'm strange. I'm talking about Big Mama Pump.
Talk about it, talk about
I'm
it.
I'm talking about Lightning Hopkins.
Talk about it, talk about
I'm
it.
Talking about
have you heard of? That's why they say I'm different.
Coming up, my interview with Allison Levy and Scott Serrano, the founders of Hortus Arboretum and Botanical Gardens in Stone Ridge. I had a chance to get a tour and hang out in the gardens with them last week on a beautiful, perfect late spring day. They have a new book. It's called Cold Hardy Fruits and Nuts. There's 50 plants in here that they've grown themselves at the Hortus Arboretum. But in addition, they say you can too, even me. So one of the things that we're going to talk about are pawpaws, which I've been a little bit obsessed with for a while. And they finally actually let me taste a pawpaw. Pretty wonderful. Anyway, that interview is coming up. Until then, some more music. Keith Jarrett from the ECM label. These are the solo concerts. That was Lazan Part 1B. Pretty incredible. I have this on vinyl because my dad gifted me all of his Jarrett albums. And because these were his, as I was opening up this incredible collection of five records last night, I found a New York Times clipping from September 28th, 1975. And it's all about Keith Jarrett and whether he's the next great innovator or cult hero. Anyway, it's a pretty wonderful early review of his career. And one of my favorite things it says in here is about this specific group of recordings. Quote, "Some listeners were repelled by the project's depths. Six sides of spontaneous emotion recollected both in tranquility and in a state of seeming panic." It's good when music does that. Anyway, Keith Jarrett, before that, The Residents, the song Breath and Length. And before that, Bette Davis. They say I'm different. Let's listen to some Eric Dolphy.
Thank you.
Jitterbug Waltz by Eric Dolphy. Allison Levy and Scott Serrano are the founders and chief growers, tenders, planters at Hortus Arboretum and Botanical Gardens in Stone Ridge. That's about 40 minutes straight south by car. Last week, I got in the car and I went and spent some time with them. In part, I discovered them because they have a new book. It's called Cold Hardy Fruits and Nuts, 50 Easy-to-Grow Plants for the Organic Home Garden or Landscape. It's chock full of beautiful photos, all sorts of examples of things that they've grown over the past 20 years at Hortus. So when I got there, I knocked on the door, went through this little gate, drove past it at first because it's perfectly tucked into the landscape, and I was met at the front door by Allison and their dogs, Georgia and Maya. And then Scott joined us, and they took me on a tour of the gardens. They have 20-plus acres. We didn't get to all of it. But we did walk and talk for about an hour, just looking at the gardens. And here's a bit of our walk and talk. You'll hear some birds in the background, some planes, and us walking, and probably some dogs. Here we go.
The world has just stopped, lost. This is edible. This is a hazelnut.
This is in the book.
Yeah, a red-leafed hazelnut. Absolutely drop-dead gorgeous. This is one of those, like, I don't understand why the world is abandoned. It's such a wonderful, delicious hazelnut. Really excellent.
And when would this fruit, would the actual nut?
Fall, like, around September, end of October. I don't know if you can see any. The nuts are starting to see. The problem is the pollinator got damaged.
Well, it's here. So, here's some. Yeah, this I'm not is seeing. The male flower.
Yeah, but I'm like, see, this may formation. Not have been pollinated because the girl got damaged. This other one got damaged. You have to have two for cross-pollination. So, like, I don't see a lot of the nuts this year. You just may not be getting the nuts this year.
Yeah. When did you put this in?
This is probably, I could look exactly, but this has probably been in the ground 12 or 14 years.
No, you're wrong. Go find the tag. Prove yourself wrong.
Where's the tag?
That's ridiculous.
Old or too young?
Too young. Wait, I would say it's older.
That's our dog tag.
Well, that was up. Oh, that's the other one. I do have it on, so part of being an arborist.
Here we go.
Wait. Can I guess? Don't say anything. So, stop. Don't say anything. I'm going to say we put it in 2000 and I'm nervous. Wait a second. 2005.
Incorrect. 2007.
Wait,
so 15 years.
We got a dog right. tag machine.
So we're both wrong. My
purple hazelnut. Got it for edible landscaping. So I put it in 2007. Rotzeller from Eastern Germany.
You should do this too.
Yeah.
So how big would it have been when you put it in?
Oh, well, we got it from, where'd we get it from?
Edible landscaping, 3 feet. And the lesson I learned from this one is grafted.
Yes,
you don't buy grafted hazelnuts because they constantly sucker the wrong thing. This is not the cultivar, it's grafted. You want one on its own root. And I didn't know that when I bought this. This is one of my early purchases, so. And at a certain point, these stop producing edible, stop becoming pollen. I think after 10 or 12 years, the branches get too woody and they don't produce. It's new shoots like this that will eventually become the pollinating ones. The older ones kind of stop. So
they continue to get their leaves, but they just don't actually
produce any.
They're not going
to get too nuts.
Right.
Yeah, it's where this is going to be stopped because anything that's not the cultivar, this is because of the grafting, this is all you have. So I didn't know that. So I'm now going to take babies of this and probably grow one out to pollinate because I want to keep the pure red strain in.
It's beautiful.
Like this is an American hazelnut and this will cross-pollinate but then it'll become diluted. I'd rather keep the American hazelnut. See, that almost looks like a nut forming right there. That almost looks like a nut forming. Or like that. Like that right there. That might be maybe a nut forming, I'm not sure. That's kind of what they look like. And these are withering back here in the shade. These need to be dug up and put out. When they have more sunlight, they're going to do better. This is just an older kind of part of the garden. See, this is from a storm. Things got damaged. And a couple of the branches.
So, eventually, we settled in the kiwi arbor in the South Garden. And they shared some homemade Shisandra berry juice, which I had never had, which was wonderful. And they told me how all of this got started more than 20 years ago.
Artwork, I think, was the entree into it because we began to plant for artwork and became obsessed with it. And I became interested because I was interested in entomology, planting things for certain insects so I could do drawings of them and photograph them. And she was collecting seeds and flower petals for her paintings because she does encaustic wax.
Leaves. And
and then that kind of spiraled out of control. We got into food and I started researching fruit from all over the world and it just went further and further and further.
I think also when we lived in San Francisco, we were two blocks from the Strybring Arboretum. I think now it's a botanical garden arboretum. So really that was our backyard and we had a little kid at the time and I think we brought her there more than we went to the playground that was like 7 blocks away.
And we would take her out of her stroller and let her run and we would go wherever she went. Recently just went back there now as an adult and I said, "Do you remember that?" And she doesn't remember, but that was our front yard because we were in an urban environment where there wasn't a place for kids to be. So That I think planted a seed. We became obsessed with plants and just being around them and
I think we're both collectors too, in a way that we like mind. To, the story that there is a story that I tell that is very true for me at least, which was when we got the field garden shortly after we had a second child. And so I took on more of that responsibility. And so the little radio boxes that they had back then, you could only really be right on the property garden. And so Scott got to go out to the field when we discovered it was ours and started doing some of the work of changing the ecosystem there in terms of digging up things and planting things. And I just remember there was a time where we both independently got one or three of the same exact plant. He remembers it as one. I remember it as many. But, we were visual artists. We didn't make a lot of money. We had two kids. And so, if we're going to do this, we need to talk to one another what plants we're getting. Why get the same thing? Why not just see if we can find different varieties or species of something similar? And I think that's when we had that very conscious early on aha moment, like, okay, let's do this. Let's collect. And he's right. I mean, we started wanting to grow our own food. Why not? And that was like, well, what other food plants are besides we had the apples, we had the peaches, we were growing apricots. And so we tried everything. And then it was like, well, what's a medlar, or Cornus moss, Cornelian cherry, just kind of expanding. And wow, it grows in a zone 5. At the time we were zone 5. Oh, it can do fine in zone 5. And then once you go through that list, which is a big list, but once you've planted all those, okay, should we try for stuff that might not be cold hardy? Okay, let's go for things that say, minus 5 degrees or 0 degrees. So, time is a lovely thing that way. It gives you that opportunity to experiment and play around.
Yeah, I sort of always say was the sort of like an aesthetically pleasing
testing station.
That's what, that I kind of feel like a testing station like Cornell and Ithaca doesn't need to be nice looking. It just needs to have a prerequisite collection and be monitored and stuff. So I like the idea of an aesthetically pleasing testing station where you're constantly trying things and experimenting. And we have things that are on the borderline of succeeding or failing, or like we have the Uzbekistani pistachios. There's our wild pistachio trees in the mountains of Uzbekistan. Are those going to make it here? Maybe not. I don't know. We've tried. And
they're still growing.
They're still growing. They're not. A couple of them have died. Right. They're not really thriving. There are plants you can tell are booming and doing real well, and there's some that are kind of just limping along and not very well. And sometimes that changes. It takes a couple years for their root systems to get big where they can really.
And we do. This is a real story that both of us can agree upon. For the Chinese kiwi, which was planted in the property garden, one of the first ones, Staisha, so you have male, female.
The Arctic kiwi
we have one under a white walnut there. So we're like, wow, this does fine in shade and it's flowering. It's not under a walnut tree with the jugon. And
we got fruit within
5 years?
It's much sooner than that. We got fruit like in 3 years.
Okay,
it's fairly
fruit
quickly.
In 3 years.
Quickly.
And
then we have the Chinese kiwi.
And it's year number 8, year number 9, year number 10.
No fruit.
And at this point, as I had said, he was doing a lot of work out in the field. I was maybe closer, although I shouldn't make it sound like he only does that and I only do this. But I became attached and I was a believer that it's going to happen. And he was threatening, let's remove it, we'll put something productive. That was the word.
About 10 or 12 years, no fruit.
But I had 3 flowers.
After 12 years, 3 flowers.
3 flowers.
No
I don't know,
fruit,
was it 12
flowers.
Years? Maybe it was 10 years with the 3 flowers. Yeah. And
next year, even a little bit more.
Yeah, we, like maybe like
two dozen. It was really exciting.
And then I think
no fruit, but still exciting.
So we're on 12 or 13 years,
all
and
right.
we get two or three pieces of fruit.
But
booming.
It's fruit. It's like, you see, this is, patience, belief, you know, being busy with other things, having the space.
It.
Like, if, look, this is what we tell people, and this is that educational part. You have a property and you don't have the space to do both, you're going to do Arctic Kiwi. Now, there is a downsize. I will say Chinese Kiwi, now that we know all that we do, we think the taste is maybe just a little bit better.
It is better.
It has a pineapple flavor, this kind of...
It's more complex.
Depth. Yeah, more
berry,
complex.
Berry kind of pineapple. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's more complex.
We do know, just because our side gig is landscaping for others and has been for a very long time, that 15 years ago, that's what everyone, all the nurseries had, the local or even the mail order. It was really more predominantly Chinese, and they call it hardy kiwi, which is confusing because that's technically, it's really not its common name. If that Chinese kiwi was in more sun, it's possible we would have had fruiting at an earlier age, not 3 or 4, but it more like 10, which
yeah,
is
instead
common.
Of 12 or 14.
So it's all these things that Scott and I have learned along the way. It's like, yeah, we truly do believe, not that we want to, but you have to kill something a couple of times to kind of figure out. Because you can read about something. You can even read something in our book, right? And have a totally different experience because of...
You learned...
Or your climate or your soil or how you planted. There's so many variables.
Yeah, you learn more from failure than you do from success.
Mm-hmm.
You learn from mistakes, mm-hmm. I'd say. You know, success is you have less reason to criticize and to examine what you did. But when you fail, you tend to look at things and go, well, what did I do wrong here? You know, how did I plant this incorrectly, or is it in the wrong aspect, or whatever, you know.
And sometimes it's just the plant.
Yeah.
It could just be the plant material. It's like people, you know, we're not all...
It's not every plant's individual.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So, we've been... I feel like I've taken a lot of your time, so I don't...
Oh,
I,
that's
we're
okay.
Going
I hope that's all right.
But, yeah, I know.
But also, you two are sitting, and I imagine, like, when I'm thinking of all of the work
we
that you
sit.
Must...
Yeah. No, we don't sit.
We don't sit.
I can see you're a little bit antsy too.
Am I? I
would say that most people who think of gardens as places where you rest, I don't experience my garden as enjoyable to rest. I walk around and grab things and taste them, or look at flower shapes and stuff. I like seeing the process.
Mm-hmm.
That's to me the best thing about living in an arboretum. When you visit an arboretum, you see it as a snapshot in time. When you live and you go start from winter, you constantly see the process of change. There, things are coming and going all the time, and that's, to me, the best part of it. So, and I stop to grab things and taste things, or I see a particular color that catches my eye, but I don't stop.
I'm much more of a stopper.
I never do this.
I really do try. I don't know how successful I am, but... I do try and, you know, have a moment here and there in a different spot, or I tend to do a little bit more of the photography.
Maybe a little bit more.
A little bit more, so meaning like I might, you know, be looking at something for a while or keep going back or noticing something, which is different because sometimes you could be in a place and you're in a more of a mode of, you know, working or planting or whatever project we're working on and not necessarily noticing.
But there's also parts of the garden I tend to tend and there's parts that she
does. Tend, yeah.
So there's parts she never goes, doesn't go to the
you don't know what right. I'm up
so,
to all
so
the
I tend
time.
To photograph that more because I'm tending that
it's
more.
True.
I learned about pawpaws about probably when we moved up here.
There's a renaissance in pawpaw culture.
So I had this idea, like, I'd like to try, I have room, I'd like to try to do that. But then, of course, things happen. But anyway, this makes me, like, that's something I really like to try maybe next year.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Lee Reich's book was one of the first ones that mentioned pawpaw, and then there was that, It won the James Beard Award for
Chelsea Green did that.
Yeah, there's a book called In Search of Pawpaws, In Search of America's
Lost
Fruit.
I can't think of
his name.
Andrew Moore.
Yeah, it won a huge amount of awards. Mm-hmm. And then last year,
what's his name?
Yeah, Michael Judd. There were three books
Michael
on
Judd's
pawpaws.
Book came out a little while ago. Actually,
two years
do you know
ago,
that
three?
Name, Michael Judd? He's based in Virginia.
Permaculture.
Or Maryland.
Maryland. Yeah,
Maryland.
Permaculture writer.
He's a nice guy. Yeah.
And then at the same time those two books were written that they just published on Amazon, there was a New York Times article about cooking with pawpaws. So it's gotten a lot of attention.
It
went from being obscure to now becoming more popular. It's good.
An it fruit.
Yeah, it's a great fruit. You know, people have a conception of a banana.
Have you had one?
I've never had
one.
Oh,
okay, so we'll send him home. Yeah. We freeze.
Well, so when I read that, and so that's a great example of like probably something that... Well, I don't know if you always had that in the version of your first manuscript, but when I read that detail about taking them out in the middle of the winter and letting them just melt just or defrost just a little bit then eating them as sorbet,
exactly.
It's wonderful.
Yeah.
That's and that's exactly,
find.
It was, you know, when you have 50 pawpaws, it's enough. It's like, you know, you don't need... You want a little batch every year to enjoy. Like, we have four or five trees. That's probably really too much.
We had hundreds.
You know, but a couple to get you a good...
But for us, it's helpful because we do let people try. We time tours here when fruit is happening.
And I will eventually graft mine. So having two or three cultivars is good because then I can graft with mine and stuff eventually.
And we're probably, you know, so we're not... a nursery, right? But we sell plants. We're not like a farm stand, but we're getting to the point where
I wondered about
gonna offer. This will probably be the first year where, you know, we have such an abundance that we pick and freeze and can and all of that. It's getting to the point where we're like, okay, let's just put it out there, and if we sell enough, we could buy a tree.
Allison and Scott sent me home with some frozen pawpaws. You can read more about how that worked out for me. And the Ginger newsletter just came out last night. And I want to repeat and underline the mission at Hortus. Allison and Scott are aiming to collect every endangered species of plants, native and non-native, to create a living textbook. That's what they call it, a living textbook for the community. Go visit the summer. It's a real oasis.
Show me how you do that trick, the one that makes me scream, she said, the one that makes me laugh, she said, threw her arms around my neck. Show me how you do it, and I'll promise you, I'll promise that I'll run away with you, I'll run away with you. Soft and only you.
as angels, dancing in the deepest oceans, twisting in the water just like a dream. You're just like a dream.
American Bird Songs, Volume 2, recorded near Ithaca, New York, unless otherwise stated, by the Laboratory of Ornithology at Cornell University. Part 1, Some Familiar Birds of Gardens and Shade Trees. First, we will hear that harbinger of spring, the bluebird, with his cheerful warble. Soon after the bluebird returns from the south, we expect to hear the phoebe calling its name. Another familiar bird in the garden is the year-round white-breasted nuthatch. During the winter, he calls only yank yank, but with the first bright days of spring, he sounds off with a soft, flicker-like call. Towards the end of the recording, the clear whistle of the chickadee is heard. This is sometimes confused with the call of the phoebe. Now the cooing notes of the familiar morning dove in a garden near a noisy road.
That's my favorite, the morning dove. That's from American Bird Songs, Volume 2, from Cornell, of course. Those are 75-year-old birds you're listening to there. Before that, Regina Spektor, Two Birds. And before that, Christian Lee Hudson, covering Just Like Heaven by The Cure. That's it for Ginger Radio Hour. Thank you so much for listening. Thanks to Allison and Scott. Go visit Hortus. Let's play a little bit more music.
Exactly what you do, how I fell in love with you. Oh, Now you love me.